John F. Kennedy was not president for a very long time in America, 1,000 days or so between inauguration and assassination. And much of the historical perspective on JFK seems to be a wondering what if. What might he have done if he had finished his term or even been reelected and served a full 2 terms? Today's guest considers what really did happen at a key time in the Kennedy presidency, and he draws some conclusions about JFK's impact. The key time is also the title of Andrew Cohen's book, 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. Andrew Cohen is a native of Canada and a longtime journalist with much recognition and many awards to his credit. His journalism career includes a stint as a Washington correspondent. Andrew is the author of 6 other books, including While Canada Slept, How We Lost Our Place in the World. Andrew writes a column read across Canada and is no stranger to broadcasting with many appearances under his belt. Andrew Cohen, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Morning, Jeff.
Good to have you. Your previous books are generally Canada-centric. Why this book?
Well, I've long been interested in JFK, and I was in Washington for several years. And for a long, long time, I've been looking for a way in. I'm one of the generation who remembers the day JFK died. I'm old enough. And that day mattered to me and so many others. And, you know, it is said there are many, many books written about JFK. There's a figure of 40,000, which I do not believe, but it is said there have been many, many books written about JFK. I didn't want to write another biography. I didn't want to write another book about the Cuban Missile Crisis or the Bay of Pigs or Vietnam. I wanted to find a way to look at JFK in a modern context and to bring him to life to a generation which may not know him, but also to push back against those who may say, you know, there wasn't a lot to say about JFK's administration other than style. Well, actually, there was a lot of substance. And on these 2 days, what I call JFK's lyrical journey to peace and freedom, these 2 momentous days, he tilts, he pivots boldly and dramatically on the 2 biggest issues of his presidency, of the decade, of his generation, nuclear arms and civil rights.
There's a real sense of a president coming into his own, feeling confident enough in the office to make significant moves on both of these issues.
Well, you know, JFK's had an uneven presidency, and as you said a moment ago, it was 1,000 days. It's not a long time. And in June of 1963, he's 2.5 years into his presidency. It has been, you know, a rough go for him. The first year, the Bay of Pigs in April of 1961, that ill-fated invasion of Cuba does not work. He has a very rough meeting with Khrushchev in May in Vienna in 1961. And then in August of that year, the Berlin Wall goes up. So he hasn't had an easy year, his first year in 61. In 1962, things are getting better. He faces down Ross Barnett, the governor of Mississippi, who is presiding over the all-white University of Mississippi in Oxford, and he forces Kennedy does the integration of that university. He faces down Khrushchev over his missiles in Cuba. And by June of 63, he's feeling much more confident as he approaches what I call his crowded hour, in which big things happen, in which he looks around and says, how can I change the channel on race and nuclear arms? How can I perhaps lift America out of the Cold War? Not so much about winning it, but perhaps about ending it. Is there a way through on civil rights? And on these 2 momentous days, which I follow hour by hour, and I had the ability to do that because I saw documentary film, which was shot in the White House on these 2 days, when you watch him and when you see how he thinks and the 2 big speeches he'll give around which these 2 days are based, you see a president becoming president. Finally, after 2.5 years, becoming the president he would like to be.
Tell us about the documentary film that enabled this process.
Well, you know, there's as we say, there's been a lot written about JFK, and historians will always rely on the same sources. The Kennedy Library is, you know, a wonderful place to be, and it is the repository of all that kind of material. So you have the presidential appointments diary. You have the Secret Service logs, and that tracks the president wherever he goes. You have oral histories. There are 1,600 of them in the Kennedy Library. You have letters and reports and that kind of thing. What I had, which no one else has seen, I am told, is that there was a documentary film made in the White House. The name of the filmmaker, was Robert Drew. Robert Drew was a photographer with Life magazine in the late 50s, early 60s. And he pioneered in the United States what was called cinema verite, which was unscripted film without big crews, without tripods, without a script or without narration, simply free-form film in which cameras would catch people as simply life was unfolding. So his first film, Robert Drew's film, big one was in Wisconsin when he covered President Kennedy, then Senator Kennedy, running against Hubert Humphrey for the Democratic nomination in the Wisconsin primary. And he followed, his crews followed both JFK and Hubert Humphrey around. He showed JFK that film in December of 1960, just before, after Senator Kennedy had been elected, but before he took office. Kennedy liked the film, and he said to Robert Drew, well, what do you want to do next? And Robert Drew said, I'd like to make a film of a crisis in the White House. When you get to the White House, I'd like to be there when there's a crisis. And the president-elect said, okay. But whenever he approached Pierre Salinger, who was Kennedy's press secretary, and said, I'd like to come film this, Salinger would say, well, it's the Cuban Missile Crisis or it's the Bay of Pigs, and we can't let you in because of matters of national security. By June of 63, Robert Drew sees that there's going to be a confrontation that will happen between George Wallace on the steps of the University of Alabama on June the 11th, 1963, when he will refuse, because he says he will do this, he's given notice that he'll do it, he'll refuse the entry of two, as they're then called, Negro students, Vivian Malone and James Hood. And he will say and give everyone notice that he said, I will not let them in. And the Justice Department can tell me otherwise, but this will be called the stand at the schoolhouse door. Robert Drew sees this, dispatches camera crews to go down south with Governor Wallace to accompany the two black students who will be accompanied themselves by deputies from the Justice Department. More important, Jeff, for us, he will dispatch a crew to stay with Bobby Kennedy, and Bobby Kennedy will take that crew with him to the White House. So there will be film of them, of Jack and Bobby Kennedy in the White House talking about all these events over these 2 days.
Andrew Cohen has many more details to share in his book, 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. Andrew Cohen visited in January 2015. You'll hear the rest shortly. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. President number 45 is now in office, but we're talking about number 35 in this hour. John F. Kennedy made a couple of major speeches on back-to-back days in June 1963. Canadian journalist Andrew Cohen focuses on those speeches on nuclear weapons and civil rights in a book called 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. There are calls from the original broadcast 3 years ago, but the interview is pre-recorded, so we can't bring in any new phone calls or emails today. You were talking about Robert Drew, the filmmaker who was able to shoot this documentary during the period covered by the book, and how often he got put off by Pierre Salinger, the White House press secretary, about, well, no, we can't do this because it's the Bay of Pigs invasion, it's the Cuban Missile Crisis, which brings us to a larger overall point right at the outset, which is that Kennedy's time in office, Andrew, seems unusually dotted with crises, just accidents of timing or deferred maintenance from the Eisenhower administration. How do you interpret this?
Well, there were many crises. Richard Nixon wrote a book called Six Crises, which he published just before he became, it was between the time he was vice president and president. By one count, there were 15 crises in the Kennedy administration. Why was that? Perhaps they were young. It was the youngest administration since the beginning of the Republic, with, I don't just mean the president, but I mean the men around him, more men than women, I would say. Perhaps it was just the nature of the time. It was the Cold War and that kind of thing. There seemed to be, whether it was the Congo or whether it was the Bay of Pigs, I mean, some was simply the bubbling international cauldron, so to speak, and others, I think it was the time, really. Some people would say it was the Kennedys' way of governing, that they actually liked crises because it would force them to do things.
You remind us later in the book how young he was at the time. Only Teddy Roosevelt was younger upon taking office, and he took office upon the death of the president for whom he was vice president, William McKinley. I have to wonder if there's a sense among historians, which you're not, I understand, but that whether other world leaders tried to haze Kennedy or something.
Well, he is a young man in an old boys club. When he becomes president on January 20th, 1961, Charles de Gaulle is in his 70s. Nehru is in his 70s. Harold Macmillan is in his late 60s. Diefenbaker of Canada is in his 60s. So, and he's in his 40s. So I wouldn't say hazing, but there was, I think, particularly from Nikita Khrushchev, and this is key to the book, because on June the 10th, 1963, Kennedy will go to American University and give the first of these two seminal speeches. And he will make an appeal to Khrushchev to see the world differently and to join with him in, as I say, ending the Cold War rather than either side winning it. He'll do this by proposing the first of the arms control treaties, which will turn out to be, in 6 weeks, the Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Khrushchev finds Kennedy young, brash, untested. Khrushchev roughs him up in Vienna and threatens to move on Berlin. But by June of 63, the two of them, having come through the Cuban Missile Crisis, which had only been 8 months earlier in October of 1962, they have a different view of the world, and they realize how fragile everything is. And the bluster that had come between them, and the kind of boasts and taunts and threats, the kind of thing that was the staple, Jeff, of Cold War rhetoric, when Kennedy goes to American University and gives that speech the morning of June the 10th, after having flown back from Hawaii all night, he sees the world differently. And he asks Americans to see the Russians differently. He asks the Americans to see the Russians as human beings. He talks about their losses in the Second World War when 20 million Russians died. He talks about their achievements in space, which, of course, where they're pressing the United States in culture, in music, in so many other ways. And he says, see them differently because he says to his audience, it's the commencement address to the class of 1963 at American University. He says to them, you know, we're all mortal. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future. When Khrushchev hears Kennedy speak, he says to Avril Harriman later on, Avril Harriman being Kennedy's diplomatic troubleshooter, who will go to Moscow within a week to negotiate that treaty, he'll say, no president has spoken of us or to us like this since Franklin Roosevelt in 1945. So Kennedy is looking for a new way, and he finds it, he articulates it in that American University speech, and that will lead to something concrete. In other words, presidential rhetoric isn't always simply meaningless. Sometimes it leads to something, and in this case it did. It led to that treaty, which was Kennedy's greatest achievement in foreign affairs. And the second day, on June the 11th, he does something very similar with civil rights in a seminal address he'll give that evening from the Oval Office, which is entirely different in preparation, but will also ask Americans to see black Americans differently, much the way the day before he had asked Americans to see Russians differently.
You know, a lot has been said, certainly in the last 6 years, about presidential speeches. Are they as important as you're portraying them to be here?
Well, they certainly were then, Jeff, but then, you know, that was a different time, obviously. It was 50 or more years ago, and authority mattered. Authority could be the school teacher, it could be the church minister, it could be the mayor of a city or the police chief. The president had a certain authority, a certain moral authority. When the president asked the networks to broadcast a speech, all three, as there were only three then, would agree immediately. And that's what happened, by the way, on June the 11th. Kennedy asked very much spontaneously, 2.5 hours before he actually went on the air to talk about civil rights. He asked the networks to give him the time, and they did. Today, President Obama can ask the networks for time, and they may not always agree. They may say, well, that address is not important enough. And so not only the exposure for the speech, but the speech itself, rhetoric, does it matter today? Well, to Kennedy, it really did. He was helped in this regard by his extraordinary speechwriter, Ted Sorensen from Nebraska, who had been with first Senator Kennedy, then President Kennedy, for 11 years. And the two of them were magic. They were perhaps the most successful partnership between a president and a speechwriter in the history of the modern presidency. And because of that partnership, almost everything Kennedy says as president, he gives many good speeches. You'll recall, Jeff, the inaugural address or the speech later that month in June in Berlin when he says, I'm a Berliner. Kennedy will give many, many good speeches because he believes that a good speech can move things, can inspire people. And what he does on June the 11th, after having given, as I say, the speech the day before at American University, on civil rights, he will ask Americans, as I say, to see things differently. He will call civil rights less a legal question now than a moral question. And he will unveil then, and this is always the news because Kennedy felt there had to be news in a speech, he will unveil what will become the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And he will, in 14 minutes, he will go on the air with an unfinished speech. He will wing it for the last roughly 2 minutes. But it will be a head-spinning, knockdown performance done entirely differently than the speech the day before. But once again, using the presidency as the bully pulpit, as Teddy Roosevelt had called it early in the 20th century, using the platform of the presidency and the rhetoric that comes from the president to move along ideas and to persuade Americans that this was the right thing to do. And on both occasions, something big comes of both rhetorical addresses.
Andrew Cohen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Canadian journalist and author. His book is 2 Days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. As you heard, we're talking about the speeches of June 10th and June 11th, 1963, the first one on the Cold War, Russia, and nuclear weapons, Soviet Union then, sorry, not Russia. And then the second speech on June 11th about civil rights, which led, in Andrew's view, to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The speech on June 10th at the American University graduation in Washington, D.C., on nuclear weapons. Now, I understand normally the process would take in the departments that were relative to the subject matter of the speech. So normally this would have been run past the State Department, et cetera, and wasn't. Is that right?
Oh, it wasn't at all. In fact, the speech which he gives on June the 10th is written largely in secret. I don't think it's too strong to use that word because it's a closely knit group in the White House which will write the speech. And as you've just said, Jeff, the usual people who would be involved, the Department of Defense, the Department of State, the CIA, perhaps even the congressional leadership, maybe the vice president, all of whom might have been involved in the preparation of a major presidential address on foreign affairs, are not involved at all. Now, why is that? The reason is President Kennedy worries that if word gets out about what he's going to say and how he's going to describe the Russians, this is the Cold War. It's 18 years into the Cold War. 8 months earlier, America and Russia have nearly incinerated themselves and the rest of the world. Kennedy believes that if word gets out about the olive branch, so to speak, that he'll extend to the Soviet Union, without in any way denying its gulags and its abuses of human rights, he figures people will try and sabotage the speech. So it is not widely circulated within the United States government. Even Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara and Secretary of State Dean Rusk will not see it, or that is the final version, until just a few hours before the president gives it. So it is written in a very different way than other speeches.
I love the description by Arthur Schlesinger about what often happened when you put something through the State Department, that they could turn the meatiest stew into the thinnest of purees.
Absolutely. And he, Arthur Schlesinger, is involved in this speech. That's the historian, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian who was on Kennedy's staff at the White House. He's a special assistant. And he provides a certain perspective on all this. I had the pleasure, Jeff, of being in his unpublished papers, which are in the New York Public Library. And he says many things there that have not yet been said before about all of these things.
Let's take a call here. We have Skeeter and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andrew Cohen, the author of 2 Days in June.
Hiya.
Hello.
In May of 1963, I lived in Southern California at Point Magoo, which was the place where the whole Pacific Missile Range had its headquarters. My father was the Pacific Missile Range safety officer. He was one who would give instructions to blow up a missile if it was going off course, that sort of thing, and he was involved with cleanup after explosions and stuff. He happened to be out in the Pacific in April of 1963 with one sailor. They tried to launch a nuclear warhead. It didn't go off correctly. My dad went out to tinker around with some wiring. The missile exploded on the launch pad. It didn't have a nuclear explosion, but he was exposed to all this radiation. He ended up getting leukemia from it and ended up dying in 91. The thing that's interesting is that in May of 63, John F. Kennedy did come to Point Magoo And I was allowed to be sitting in the VIP section with my dad. And I was like a foot or so away from Kennedy, and he was amazingly tan and very vibrant and all that. Well, another coincidence is that that speech that he gave on June 10th, followed by a few weeks later the signing of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, my father's sister, my aunt, was one of the highest women in the State Department at the time. And she was standing next to Kennedy when he signed that treaty.
Wow. That's some interesting connections.
Ironic.
And what was her name?
Her name was Virginia Duke.
Virginia
and
Duke.
She ended up being on What's My Line.
Oh, really?
Really? Two other people were trying to be imposters, and she was sort of cited for that.
All right. Thanks for the story, Skeeter. Really much appreciate you sharing that with us. Which brings us to a point when we were talking about the nuclear weapons and some of the things that could have gone wrong. There are some real not-for-public sorts of thoughts that you convey in the book about Kennedy's thoughts about nuclear weapons.
Well, Kennedy was worried. And when you're the commander-in-chief, you have to project strength, which, of course, he did. Kennedy was a former naval officer in the Second World War, decorated war hero. Certainly had his credentials as a Cold Warrior. He presided over, Jeff, the largest military buildup in peacetime between 1961 and 1963. That's how worried he was about America's preparedness for the Soviets, if it came to that. But at the same time, he's thinking about peace, and that's the critical thing here. The caller just talked about the president in Southern California. I don't know if it was the same visit. He said May, but in the 5 days before the president makes the speech at American University, he is touring Western military bases. He's in China Lake, California. He's in Colorado Springs, and he's seeing the latest weaponry. And, of course, the Pentagon is always developing this stuff because it has to. I mean, this is the Cold War, and there is allegedly, or Kennedy has said, there's a missile gap, a gap between the number of missiles the Soviets have and that which the United States has, though what he didn't say in the 60 campaign, it was way in the United States' favor, but it wasn't convenient to say that then. But they're testing all the time, and they're filling the atmosphere with poisons. And Kennedy says this has to stop. And so the appeal he makes to Khrushchev in this speech at American University is not just to, of course, appeal to Americans to see things differently. He also very concretely says, we will stop testing nuclear weapons, and we invite you to do the same. And Khrushchev will take him up on that offer, and it's their first attempt, despite all the bravura and the talk and the threats, to get down to business and to try and put the brakes on this runaway nuclear juggernaut. And that's what they're trying to do in Moscow. That's why they come to that agreement. It isn't a comprehensive nuclear test ban. It's only limited. It will forbid testing in the atmosphere. Tests will still continue below ground, and it won't stop the Cold War. But Kennedy, after that speech, imagines doing business with Khrushchev. He hopes to go to Moscow. Kennedy does in 1964. He goes to the United Nations in September of 63 and talks about collaborating with the Soviets in space, which was unusual considering America was then in a space race. Kennedy had promised to send an American to the moon and return him safely to home before the decade was out, as he put it. And of course, America did do that. But while Kennedy is projecting a very strong sense of strength, he's also seeing or trying to see a way through to a new arrangement, a new rapprochement with the Soviet Union.
Andrew, do you get the sense that this was set up in part by the Cuban Missile Crisis months earlier, in the same sense that, for example, only the view from historians is that only an unrepentant Cold Warrior like Richard Nixon could finally go to China in 1972, that because Kennedy was tough in the Cuban Missile Crisis, he could then be the one to soften later on?
I think so. Although tough as Kennedy was, former military, former naval officer that he was, there were very strong elements. I mean, this speech, which is called now, Jeff, the peace speech, and is looked upon as perhaps Kennedy's greatest speech. Certainly, Ted Sorensen thought it was his greatest speech. That speech came out of thinking. And it came out of a reflection. But that doesn't mean that everyone accepted that view. When Kennedy made that speech, his fiercest critics said, you're soft on communism. And, you know, Kennedy, as I've just said, had presided over the largest defense buildup in American history in peacetime. But that wasn't good enough for some people who could never imagine doing business with the Soviets because the Cold War simply wouldn't allow it. So, yes, Cuba, in a sense, made Kennedy and Khrushchev aware of the power in their hands. Kennedy kept talking about the children. He himself had two young children, Caroline and John John. And he, too, wondered what the future would be like and would we be as maniacal as to blow ourselves up. And Kennedy gave an interview in 1961 and said, you know, I study history. Ever since the longbow was developed, if we have a weapon, we'll use it. And he was afraid they were going to use nuclear weapons, and they had to find a way not to.
That speech led to the Test Ban Treaty. The next night's speech led to civil rights legislation. That's how Andrew Cohen pulls it all together in 2 days in June. John F. Kennedy and the 48 hours that made history. You'll hear the rest of the interview here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. John F. Kennedy didn't have a lot of time in office, but he definitely left a legacy. And Canadian journalist Andrew Cohen traces two particular pieces of legislation, one on nuclear weapons, the other on civil rights, to a pair of speeches on back-to-back days. Andrew Cohen's book is 2 days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 Hours That Made History. Since it is pre-recorded, you know the drill, no new phone calls or emails. So, obviously, the Kennedy speech, the peace speech, as it's known at American University on June 10th, 1963, didn't come out of nowhere. Can we assume that with some of the ideas that were laid out in the speech, that there had been certainly back-channel communications between the Americans and Soviets since the Cuban Missile Crisis?
There were, through Pope John and through Norman Cousins, who was the editor of the Saturday Review in New York. Yes, there was a back channel. Kennedys liked back channels. They used them in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And there had been a lot of discussion, and there was a correspondence growing between President Kennedy and Premier Khrushchev, which has been since published. But there was no way they could talk to each other on the phone because, Jeff, it wasn't until that summer that a hotline, as it was called, was installed between Washington and Moscow. So when Kennedy does make the peace speech, he has to wait a long time for Khrushchev to acknowledge that he's heard it. And the Americans will be encouraged when they hear from the American ambassador in Moscow around midnight Washington time, on just in the early hours of June the 11th, that Khrushchev had done something that had not been done in the Cold War. He had stopped jamming American Russian broadcasts on Voice of America. And he would allow the entire text in the Russian language to be heard on the Voice of America, and he would allow it to be reprinted in Izvestia, the state newspaper in Russia, in Russian, of course, and by TASS, the news agency. So Kennedy, he liked what he heard. He, as I say, had not expected an American president to talk about him that way. And it's interesting because the next night when Kennedy talks about race, Martin Luther King had not expected JFK to talk the way he did. And when King hears Kennedy after his moving, passionate address to Americans for 14 minutes that evening, he jumps up out of his seat and says to his friend Walter, he said, "Walter, do you believe that white man stepped up to the plate and hit it out of the park?" And then he dashed off a telegram to the president saying, "No one has talked about us, black Americans, that way since Abraham Lincoln."
And as you indicate in the book, Martin Luther King Jr. himself had been pretty critical right to the president about his lack of visibility. Had the president, in fact, been something of an invisible figure in civil rights talk up to that point?
To King, he certainly was. And to the American Jewish Congress, who took out an ad in the New York Times, which John F. Kennedy would have seen as he flew back or when he arrived back in Washington early in the morning of June the 10th, the American Jewish Congress called Kennedy's civil rights policy a folly and a failure. Reverend King, who had given an interview to the New York Times in that very issue, Monday, June the 10th, said of the Kennedy administration, it had merely replaced Eisenhower's miserable policy on civil rights for an inadequate one. The thing is, Jeff, that Reverend King did not know what was going on in the White House over these 2 days. He did not know that the Kennedys, and that would be, of course, the president and Bobby Kennedy, his attorney general, were busy finding ways to confront George Wallace in Alabama, to force him from the schoolhouse door, to admit those two black students, and to announce the Civil Rights Act of 1964, as it would then become. So Reverend King doesn't know that, and he's surprised. And King, who had been suspicious of Kennedy, who had considered Kennedy insensitive on civil rights, and it is true to a degree that the Kennedys did not do as much as, of course, the black leadership wanted them to do, although the Kennedys would say, but look at our Congress. It is controlled by white Southerners who are dead set against any kind of change in the white supremacist South. King cannot believe what he's heard, and the March on Washington, which will happen on August 28th, where Martin Luther King will give his famous I Have a Dream speech, that march was originally supposed to be in opposition to the administration. But it's not in opposition to the administration. It's then in opposition to Congress and trying to prod Congress to move on civil rights legislation, which Congress will do eventually when Lyndon Johnson becomes president, and he will drive it through, and it will become the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Overall, Andrew, how were JFK's relations with Congress at that point in history?
Kennedy's worried about his whole legislative program because although Congress was controlled by Democrats, the Democrats were largely from the South. And the South was the heart of the Democratic Party. And Kennedy knows and is told not to go ahead with his speech. He's told not to go ahead with the Civil Rights Act then because he says you won't get it through Congress. You need to do a lot more legwork. You need to do a lot more public persuading. And the speech that he does give, which everybody but Bobby Kennedy says he shouldn't give, including Ted Sorensen, who wrote it, that's the beginning of that very public campaign to persuade Americans, North and South, to look at civil rights through with a moral perspective rather than simply a legal one. I wanted to say, in addition, Jeff, that a lot else is going on in the White House over these 2 days. And when you follow, as you say, the president in a time capsule, I call it the TikTok of the American presidency, hour by hour, a lot else is going on. He's not just dealing with nuclear symmetry and civil rights. He's going swimming in the White House pool, which he does twice a day. He's meeting a stream of visitors with whom he'll talk about opening up immigration. He'll talk about a tax cut. He'll talk about physical fitness and diet with what I call his envoy of exercise. He'll talk about the Cold War with a visiting French historian. He'll talk about the space program with his administrator, chief space administrator. So the president is doing a lot of other things on these 2 days, including in the evening of June the 10th, going to a dinner party at the home of Joseph Alsop, who was a leading journalist of his day. And the talk that evening is all about the big sex and spy scandal breaking in London called the Profumo scandal, which absolutely absorbs Kennedy. He's reading all the cables from London because he is fascinated by what's going on in Britain and probably worried that something similar could happen in the United States.
Well, it's interesting that Kennedy is riveted by the Profumo scandal, which was a sex scandal ultimately, and yet I think you point out in a very short half sentence that Kennedy also visited his mistress somewhere in those 2 days.
Well, when I say visited, he at the dinner party at which he attends at Joseph Alsop's house, which has the British ambassador to the United States, David Ormsby Gore, and his wife, and they are very good friends of JFK and other luminaries, including Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense. One of the women there will be Mary Meyer, and Mary Meyer is the sister-in-law of Ben Bradlee, who's the late Ben Bradlee, former editor of the Washington Post. She will be at that dinner party, and JFK, you know, when you track a president for 48 hours, you know where he is hour by hour, but there is a period of about an hour and 10 minutes when he simply disappears. So I don't know where he's gone, but he had seen his lover at that dinner party, and Jackie was away in Camp David for these 2 days. So that is simply something that happens, but he's pretty busy with a lot of other stuff going on, including Vietnam as well. June the 11th, 1963, when he will give that civil rights speech after they faced down George Wallace and called out the National Guard to force him from the door, it will be called by historians the most important day in the history of the civil rights movement because something else will happen early in the evening of June the 12th in a segregated subdivision in Mississippi that will show Kennedy a shocking thing will happen. I'm kind of leaving it there so readers will perhaps go to the book and learn about it. But there Kennedy will learn about the urgency and the penalty, in a sense, of what he's just said hours earlier in his address to the nation.
I am leaving a lot of detail out, obviously, because we have an hour here, but it's a very good, well-researched and very thorough book. Back to civil rights generally, though, curious about how much of what went on at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa that day was choreographed. I've been reading just recently about the fact that while George Wallace was making his stand in the doorway, that the students were coming in another entrance and actually getting themselves registered.
Well, when you say choreographed, there have been some who say that, just to back up for our listeners, so Wallace has announced that at 10:30 a.m., or actually it's 11 a.m. in Tuscaloosa, which is in central Alabama, that's the home of the University of Alabama, he will stand in that door at Foster Auditorium, which is where all students register, and say to the two black students, 20-year-old Vivian Malone and James Hood, who have been chosen by the NAACP to make this challenge, he will refuse personally to let them register. And the Kennedys have been wondering, you know, do we have to arrest him? And if we arrest him, do we have to charge him with contempt of court? And if we do, will there be a riot in Tuscaloosa, because there are 15 or 20,000 Klansmen gathered outside Tuscaloosa, and they have told Wallace, we will offer you our help whether you want it or not. Wallace is saying he doesn't want violence, but he may lose control of the situation, and the Kennedys well know that. So there there is a sense, though, among some historians that show at the schoolhouse door, and the Kennedys realized that Wallace needed to have a show because he was a fervent segregationist who had won the governorship only a few months earlier on a racist platform. They feel that he will need his show. That it was choreographed, though, simply wasn't so, in the sense that did they know what Wallace would say, and they certainly knew how they would respond given what they thought Wallace might say. But there are some people like John Lewis, the great John Lewis, who's in Congress and who was in the Civil Rights Movement. He's in Congress now, but he was in the Civil Rights Movement then, who say, well, it was all set up. Well, I can tell you, Jeff, I've watched the film of the Kennedys strategizing for these 2 days and earlier. I've watched the preparations that were made in enormous intimate detail, and I can tell you that it wasn't choreographed because it couldn't have been. Yes, they knew what they would do with those students, because you're absolutely right. When George Wallace said, you can't enter, the students never went to the door with Nick Katzenbach, who represented the Justice Department. The Kennedys did not want them humiliated. Their dignity was very, very important. Preserving their dignity was important to the Kennedys. What they did do, as you've just alluded, is they were taken to their dormitories, to which the Justice Department had gotten keys, and they were just sent to their dormitories, and they were registered another way because the court had ordered their registration. What Wallace was doing was simply putting on a show. Legally, they were registered, but Wallace wanted the spectacle of refusing them. In the afternoon, he will reappear at the door. Meanwhile, the Kennedys will have nationalized or federalized the National Guard, sent it up to Tuscaloosa, and were ready simply to carry Wallace off. But they didn't have to do that because Wallace realized the game was up, the two would be registered, the university would be integrated. It was the last of the big southern institutions to be integrated, and he had lost. Of course, he didn't really lose because he ran for president 4 times after that, always on that kind of an anti-establishment platform. But the Kennedys saw that crisis unfolding in the afternoon. It was then that Kennedy says at 5:40 p.m. in the afternoon, he turns to Ted Sorensen and says, Ted, it's time to make that speech on civil rights tonight. And Ted says, what speech? There was no speech. And it's at that point Ted Sorensen feverishly begins writing the speech that JFK will give. It will be an unfinished speech. It will be an incomplete speech when JFK goes on the air at 8 p.m. He's booked the networks, as we discussed earlier, but it will be a masterpiece.
It's amazing that amount of time. There was no speech, so Ted Sorensen pounded out something.
He pounded out something, and the interesting thing is he's not the only person doing it. The president goes to the cabinet room with Bobby arrives from the Justice Department, and they're working away at something. The president is trying to get a hold of Arthur Schlesinger, who's gone off to his 25th college reunion at Harvard, and he is supposed to be at Symphony Hall in Boston listening to the Boston Pops. So the crack White House telephone operators are trying to locate Arthur Schlesinger, and they're paging him, if you can imagine this comical scene. They're paging him at Symphony Hall. Arthur Schlesinger isn't there, though. He's gone somewhere else, and in those days, no one carries a cell phone. And they couldn't get him. So the president, when he needed Arthur Schlesinger the most, couldn't find him. But meanwhile, it was a job for Ted Sorensen. And what does he do, Jeff? He reaches back to a valedictory address he gave at the University of Nebraska in the late 1940s. And there he talks about the plight of the black American in the 40s, and it had not changed much in the early 1960s. And he talks about, if you are a black American today, you have a third of a chance of going to college. You will live 7 years. Your lifespan will be 7 years shorter than a white person. You will only have half of his income. And Kennedy says this and asks Americans, given this, would you be content if the color of your skin were black? Of course you wouldn't. And so we have to see things differently.
All right, it's an amazing set of circumstances there and an amazing 2 days in June. And yes, there's a lot of detail we left out because it really does go hour by hour. 2 days in June, John F. Kennedy and the 48 hours that made history. Andrew Cohen wrote it. He's been our guest on The Exchange. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeff.